Okay, just let me introduce the interview then. So I'm Alexander Freund, and with me is Nolan Riley. We're both from the University of Winnipeg, and we are co-editors of the Oral History Forum d'Histoire Orale, the Journal of the Canadian Oral History Association. And we're doing an interview today about Foxfire. Today is August the 18th, 2011, and we are here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. We have three people with us from the Foxfire Project. One is Hilton Smith from Piedmont College, Sarah Tucker, also from Piedmont College and from Baldwin Elementary School. David Forker, a teacher at middle school at Coyle Middle School in Athens, Georgia. And I think you're all three from Athens or that sort of area.
Okay. No. Northeast of Athens, Cornelia, small town.
Okay.
I'm based at the Demarest, the original campus for Piedmont College.
All right.
David did his work at the Athens campus for Piedmont College.
Okay. Excellent. Great. And you're happening to be in Winnipeg, not by coincidence, but because we have organized a summer institute for history teachers in Manitoba. And this year's topic is oral history storytelling. And we invited you to talk about Foxfire, the project, the approach, and we heard a lot about Foxfire, but we do want to share it with our readers or listeners. So maybe you can just start by telling us, what is Foxfire?
The term Foxfire was adopted by students at a school in Northeast Georgia in Rapin County to identify a student journal for writing intended to help students acquire skills in English language and appreciation of literature. And as the project grew, a sense of what to name it grew out of the fact that Foxfire phenomena, the phosphorescent lichen that grows on old oak trees that are down in wet areas, glows in the dark. The students adopted that as the name for this magazine, and that's where the name came from. So it doesn't have anything particularly to do with literacy or oral history or anything. It's just a cultural, local phenomenon that they liked. And as this magazine grew, it began to take a life of its own. The source of material for the magazine became out of interviews with local residents in this rural Northeast Georgia area. They are Appalachian folks, Scottish descent primarily, mostly rural, but there are some mills and some enterprises like that in the area. And the students interview those folks and learn how to edit those interviews into readable articles that maintain the voice of the original person. That then gave the magazine its characteristic, and it had the effect then of attracting an audience of people in the region who appreciated having their culture, their heroes, their unique individuals identified and talked to, and their voices heard out there. So it had the sort of incidental effect of spreading an appreciation for how people in that region lived, how they solved problems, how they coped with difficult times, and the fact that it's a poor region. Without intending it to be such, it became a kind of a celebration for that Appalachian, Southern Appalachian culture. And as the magazine grew, other teachers in other parts of the country began to hear about it, primarily because of the publication of a book by Doubleday called The Foxfire Book. The book itself is a compilation of articles done by the students over a period of a number of years, selected by a new group of students as like the best of articles, and that became then the Foxfire Book. And the sales of that book were enormous and generated revenues to Foxfire that it could then use for other projects. Then as years went by, the possibility of using that general concept in things other than journalism and literacy and English courses began to appear. For example, I'm in the area of history. So we began the process of sort of adapting, if you will, the Foxfire concept notion to other grade levels, to other subject areas, to other demographics. And in that process, we've involved a lot of teachers in a lot of different regions around the country. And the word approach then began to use, that was the language that we began to adopt to describe this adaptability, these adaptations of the Foxfire cultural journalism mode into other subject areas, other grade levels. And with that came the evolution of what's referred to as the Foxfire core practices, which then which evolve and change as we work with new groups of folks to apply this in different contexts, different places.
So what was the initial reason for doing something different in the classroom?
Panic. Almost every teacher I know has experienced facing a group of students and that glazed over expression that comes back to you from those faces, expecting you to make learning come alive. And that too oftentimes doesn't happen. It's the reason children celebrate when school is over for the summer or for a holiday. It speaks to what is wrong that the place where we come together to learn, to grow, to create is flawed. And the original person who started Foxfire, Elliot Wigginton, faced just such a thing in his first teaching assignment. He was teaching a group of ninth grade English students who there was such a disconnect that at one point one student attempted to set fire to the podium. So in an unusual move, teacher moving away from the position of authority, Elliot said to his students, "Okay, we both know this is not working. It's not working for me. It's not working for you. What can we do together?" And that was really the start of it. The sharing of authority, the moving away from the hierarchy of teacher as the primary person and students as lower level beings. And that's maybe the heart of what this lens is all about, is respect for the learner as well as for the teacher, that mutual respect.
So what was the first project that teacher did?
He responded to this situation by saying to them, you know, how could we do this? We're supposed to learn about English. And most of these kids from that Northeast Georgia area were definitely deficit in terms of language skills. But they brainstormed possibilities of how he might do this, which I thought was a key that he opened himself up to that. And they identified the idea of having a student publication as the vehicle. So that's the one they settled on, and that's what they tried to do for a while, with the students themselves writing and composing. But obviously with the skill levels where they were, it was not exactly a stellar success of an enterprise. Until two students interviewed the local former sheriff, who had this wonderful story about a bank robbery that he pursued, and that caught on. And even the students then in the school, who were residential students then, began to interview people in the region as the source of information. So the initial thing was a very clumsy, inept effort by the students to have their own publication, but then got grounded in a look at the Appalachian culture via, or if you will, oral history or interviews.
Can you tell us more about the sheriff's story?
Yeah, this there was a bank robbery back in the 1930s, I think around 1936-38. And so these guys from out of town showed up and they robbed the bank. And on their way out of town, they robbed the hardware store for a bucket of nails, which they then strewn down what is now US 76 West to delay the pursuit of anybody who might be chasing them. And this guy was a sheriff, so he pursued them. He did catch them, by the way. And he got them despite the nails and got them into jail. And this had, in the legend, in Appalachian area, we tell stories. We do not always true stories. We sort of, we like to exaggerate and make good tales out of them as well as stories. And this thing, he had become kind of a legend in the area and did his stories in front of the Kiwanis Club, the Chamber of Commerce, church groups, and had worked this thing into pretty much of a routine. So the two boys, local boys, desperate for a story for the magazine, interviewed him. And it was interesting that as the sheriff, who's now getting on in years, tried to do the story, there would be little lapses or gaps in his memory. His wife was standing right there beside him, and she would sort of whisper or give him a nudge, and he would, oh, yeah, that's right, and he would then put that part in. And so the boys tried to write this down. You know, this is a school that didn't have tape recorders and stuff to try to write down. And when he went back and tried to make a story out of it, it obviously didn't do very well. So they did borrow a tape recorder, went back out, did their interview again. And this time they transcribed this what was on the tape.
Recorded.
And that didn't work because the storytelling has many sort of dangling antecedents and clumsy constructions and things that don't connect. And so it didn't read very well. So the next challenge to them, and this is where the rest of the class began to get involved, is how to maintain the sheriff's voice, his personality, but at the same time create something that was literary, that was readable. And that then became the model, and the rest of other students began to see that, and that became then the kind of criteria, if you will, for what got into the magazine. It had to maintain that voice, but it had to be authentic, but it had to be pretty good literature. The effect of this, by the way, is that those students who were, they had third and fourth grade literacy levels when they were in the ninth grade, many of them, and they leapt up and came up to grade level in a hurry and beyond. They had characteristics, capabilities that I would say were like 10th and 11th graders at least by the end of that school year, even though we're the ninth graders, because they wanted this to be right, mm-hmm. wanted it to be readable. It gave them, if you will, a purpose for learning this and being good at it.
I have one question about. I mean, all of this sounds wonderful. Sounds like mm-hmm. it's a wonderful way to sort of engage students. Is it sort of a panacea for teachers? Is this sort of an easy way to change the way we teach? And maybe, yeah, maybe David, you can talk about this from your own practice.
So we've discussed this a lot with how it looks if you utilize the Foxfire approach. And in one hand, from an outside perspective, it may appear that there's a lack of planning. But in reality, there's a lot more thought and planning that needs to go into the type of situation, because when you do turn over the classroom to the children and the students in this way, you really don't know what's going to happen, because you never know what they're going to think of. But as a teacher, we do have certain givens that we have to make sure that we introduce the students to, and things that they need to learn and skills they need to acquire. So it's kind of a balance of how do I accomplish what I have to accomplish mm-hmm. in a way that they want to do it. So where it may seem like I'm not writing, you know, these little plans where I have a student doing this one task and then to the next task, a lot of thought goes into all these different possibilities that will come out of what they generate.
And perhaps making that transparent connection to the children. This is our goal this year. These are our expectations. These are the things that we must accomplish. But how we accomplish them is up to us. So, how can we do that? So many times we, as teachers, keep that as some sort of sacred secret that we know what we're going to teach to you, the waiting vessel, being the children, and we don't tell them. What a loss that is. When we work together, then the myriad of possibilities, far beyond what a teacher would think would be appropriate. And the real impetus is that we can't know what the interests of the children are until we give them the opportunity to tell us what they are.
Yeah, we have figured out that, and make a point that it is not a panacea. In fact, it's hard work. And a lot of teachers will launch off onto this and sort of realize that, this is hard work. So we encourage them, look at those 10 core practices and sort of figure out where you might start with what group. And if you teach a full schedule, for example, in a high school, pick one class to just work with. Don't try to do your entire schedule that way until you begin to get a handle on this and have some experience with it. And then as time goes on, you can work towards more fulfillment of those 10 core practices. Even in those wonderful transitory times when you realize that all 10 of them have functioned for a short period of time, and it is a shining moment, it's a passing moment, because the bell rings and the next class is there, the next year is there, new curricula arrive, so you've got new things to solve, and you've got new demographics in the school. All those kind of things can affect then the challenge you face the next time. So it is hard work to do this well. But the fulfillment that comes from it is really powerful, and it is renewing to have that take off in the classroom and see students achieve who otherwise would not have.
And even when things go badly, when the product isn't satisfactory to anybody, to the teacher, to the students, there's much learning there. Okay, where did we go wrong? What would we do next time? So the learning doesn't have to turn out in any certain predetermined way. It is what it is. And you learn from the things that turn out well and the things that don't turn out so well.
Mm-hmm. And as we're sitting here, we don't want to intend to denounce pedagogy by any means. Because really when you utilize the Foxfire approach, all those different pedagogies that you've studied and learned and all these different flexible groups and these different techniques of revising and editing and evaluating and assessing all have to be kind of ready to go at any given point, because you're not really sure which direction the kids are going to go and when these particular types of pedagogies and methods are appropriate.
Right.
And as in embracing and utilizing Foxfire approach, you quickly determine, or methodically, depending on how you're working with your children, students, when is the right time to use these research-based practices and all these things that are important in education. So it's not like disregard all of these research-based things that have been developing in the world of education by any means,
right.
But you're approaching them in a different manner where the students have so much more voice and control over what and how, and you work with them versus...
That's critical, David. That's a really, and there is an appropriate time for lecture, although
direct instruction
that we tend to, that has become we don't do that. That's not a good thing, and yet it is an appropriate thing sometimes.
Particularly if the students themselves will say, as it happened in my classroom, there was one particular concept in economics that seemed to be very elusive, and I was a little, you know, came back and I said, we're not getting this. And somebody said, well, you understand it, right? And I said, yeah. And they said, well, tell it to us. And I said, like lecture? And they said, yeah. Well, it was a very different lecture as a result of the fact that they were purposeful in wanting it. It turned out to be more interactive as they asked a lot of questions, which would not normally have occurred. And I think to piggyback on David's comment, I think one of the things that we're doing is we're helping our students acquire repertoire that they can draw on. And once they have that, then they can make more informed decisions. So one of our roles is to equip them with that repertoire of activities, skills, and so forth, so that they can then figure out how to do the work more effectively.
David, to make this approach a little more concrete, could you give us an example from your classroom how you apply Foxfire?
Certainly. The beginning of the year is my favorite time to use it. Because I'm just getting to know the students, and the class is just getting up and running. You know, we're figuring out how everything's schedules are going and such. And I really utilize the first core practice, which I can even articulate verbatim. From the beginning, learner choice, design, and revision infuses the work teachers and learners do together. So I completely go away from it's my classroom notion and welcome to my room and here's where my desks are and my books are here and my this and my that. And I kind of intentionally have everything in a pile, just kind of a mess. And they walk in and they kind of look at me trying to figure out you know, they check the room number, these types of things, and they're, okay, we're here. And I say hello and welcome them and let them know, you know, you're in the right place. And then I mentioned, you notice the room is a mess. But then I said, well, let's set it up. How do you want to do this? So from the beginning, they're like, oh, we have a choice in that, which can be a disaster. You have to be ready for. So, you know, and as with kind of approaching it, say, with the absence of planning, just in case, I always have a slide ready or a poster ready that says, if they're kind of just standing there, I say, well, look at the board, and I encourage them to put the desks in a circle without talking, you know, so that nonverbal communication could take place. And we develop from there and ask them about norms. We spend a lot of time establishing norms, even before we dive into curriculum, which I would argue is time well spent, and defining what a norm is from each other, because they're used to rules. They're usually told not to do this, not to do that. And once they define what a norm is, then I get them to tell us what our norms should be. You know, how should we operate in this class? How are we going to respect each other? We're multiracial. We have different ethnicities. We have different languages. You know, how are we going to know how to treat each other? And I've seen it a couple times where they make this whole list of rules or norms, and it's do not do this, do not do that. And I would actually point out to the students, I said, they just want to have you notice, you're pointing out all these things to not do. What should we do? And it's just their mindset kind of adjusts, mm-hmm. like, wow, which they're so used to be told not. So their voice is coming out so quickly. And then we move into, I ask them how they like, what do they want to learn? How do they want to learn it? How do they want to show me they've learned it? Mm-hmm. You know, all these different things that give them a lot of choice.
David, can you share from this morning at breakfast, you were talking, the preamble that yes. you were studying, and your students then, with that as a model, created the norms, the constitution for their class. And
so, yeah, going right along with what I was describing just now, we had the students coming up with norms, and then they decided they wanted a class name. So we gave them opportunity to have a class name. And then with the class name, we had them as a writing assignment, because we have narrative is our unit we're studying. And we encouraged them to come up with statements of things that they can or will do in the class. I can succeed in seventh grade. I will. So then in groups, they came back and they shared with each other, and they kind of narrowed it down to a statement or two that each group wanted to share, and then each group shared with the class, and we put them on the class, and we put them on the wall, and then as a class, we kind of filtered those down into one constitution. So I shared it this morning because they're almost a little apprehensive to have so much voice. Mm-hmm. But they came up with this constitution, and they named themselves the Loose Cougars, because in helping them understand that we don't have rules, that we have norms, they felt like they were turned loose. You know, and our school mascot's the Cougars. So the student wrote this idea, said, we're the Loose Cougars because we can do what we want, and we're going to do the best, in this really cute narrative that he put together. And then they all voted out of three or four, and that's the one they all wanted. So this is what they came up for their class, the constitution, to give you an example of how this would work. We, the Loose Cougars of Room 211, promise to do our best every day, be responsible, respect each other and ourselves, remember that each person is unique and each voice needs to be heard, and establish a group of free-thinking students to create harmony and peace in an environment full of norms.
Can you tell us more about the students, like your students, like where are they from? And
sure, seventh graders in this particular class. It's a collaborative class. There's a group of students that have been identified as gifted, as well as regular education students, and then I'm there to be a resource for the ESOL students. White, black, Latino, male, female. The majority of them are probably economically disadvantaged.
Any other ethnicities and languages other than Spanish?
We do have one student from Burma. He speaks Karen, the Karen language. And it's fascinating to watch the students interacting, because he's obviously not on English grade level. but the student's now starting to help him with things already. And we've only been up and running for about a week. So it's definitely a mixed group. It's not certain one type of ethnicity or language. So.
What's the response of the parents to this program?
In my situation, the students I have, they're just glad that they have teachers that are working with them. They're always, yes, okay, thank you. So there hasn't really been, I don't have one of those school situations where the parents might complain or be so involved. Our parents are kind of, as my principal says, our families are kind of existing. You know, they
work. Surviving.
They're surviving. So to know that their kids are at school and safe, they're just happy with that. And I think we did an oral history project last year where the students did family narratives, and a lot of migrant students. And we had the students interview family members and maybe talk about how they traveled from one country to another or what it was like before they left their home, you know, their native country. And we had the parents come in and they were very happy to be included in what their children were doing. We didn't explicitly tell them that this was part of the Foxfire approach, but having the voice there was.
Yeah, that can be an aspect of this that has to be attended to, though, because you don't want to just assume that the parents are going to be happy with this. And in most cases, because what the students are doing involves the community in some way, in a positive fashion, it's considered, you know, it's a good thing to do and the parents are supported. There are situations, particularly more affluent communities, where the notion of completing the state's required curricula is much more important, or seems to be more important. So one way that Foxfire folks reassure parents of that kind is, we know what the state's givens or expectations are. We intend to fulfill those. We do not intend for them to be a limiting factor, however, in how our students are engaged, really engaged in the subject matter. So usually that reassurance takes care of that concern that school is not being done the way they experience it and the way they think it ought to be done, continued.
One of the core principles, or the foundation of Foxfire, is collaboration. Mm-hmm. Is collaboration something for every student? What do you do if a student does not cooperate in collaboration?
Mm-hmm. Since we have assigned them a sense of responsibility, or getting them to acquire a sense of responsibility for their own learning. And schooling tends, from about second, third grade on, to move that responsibility away from the student and to others, faculty, other folks are responsible for this. So it's kind of a tricky business. But if you're genuine with this, you have to realize that there are going to be students who, for reasons of their own, are going to be reluctant to do anything that's collaborative. So as long as they are continuing to do the effective work as needs to be done, they can work solo. And what we suggest in our courses for teachers is that they make that possibility for students that are just phobic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, gifted students or academically talented students have often experienced the group work, quote unquote, in a negative fashion because they end up doing all the work. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who mm-hmm. can succeed. The rest of the group sits back and takes advantage of this. So they've had bad experiences with it. And so we suggest in the course, create a space where those folks can work on their own. But if they begin to show some interest in becoming part of a group or a collaborative situation, they have to negotiate their way into that relationship. They have to go to the group and say, okay, I'd be interested in being part of what you're trying to do here. And the group has the voice then of saying, okay or not so okay, or here's what it means to be part of this group, you know, our expectations. So we counsel teachers that are in our program to work that way with those students so that nobody ever feels really deprived. Now, there are students who will use that as an excuse not to do anything. That's just the reality of classrooms and adolescence. So you have that situation. And all of us have experienced times when we never really quite got those mm-hmm. kids up and into it. You do what you can, do your best, you confer with them, try to give them opportunities. But at some point, they have to pay the consequence of not being willing to at least take a little bit of risk and move out there and join us. It's sad, but it's a real reality of classroom life.
And Hilton's comments actually go back to the planning aspect. Yes. Because if you think of the implications of what he just described and the planning involved to give that academically gifted child the opportunity to work on their own, now you have group planning, but also you have to have something mm-hmm. for this other child to work on their own and extension activities where they're maybe going to keep on going. There's a lot more planning going on than just saying, okay, kids, do whatever you want.
Right, yeah. There's a wonderful story about a teacher who was a prospective teacher who had done the Foxfire course. She found herself in this particular large U.S. history classroom, had like 30 students in it, and there were three male students who were repeating the course who were disruptive. That's one thing if you don't want to learn, that's one thing, but you to not want to learn and disrupt other people's learning, you can't have that. So she was frustrated about what to do with this, and her host teacher, her supervising teacher, didn't seem to be helpful with this group, these three kids. So her class had one of those unfortunate scheduling things where the half the class occurred, then they break for lunch, and then they come back after lunch to finish the class. It's a horrible thing to do to anybody, but it's rife in Georgia schools anyway. So she said, that's how this class was done, and so she was so frustrated with this, and when they broke for lunch, she reformed the room, put three desks right together in the front of the room, isolated from all other students, big space around them, and put a name tag on them. And so when they came back from lunch, the three guys found their places right in the very front of the room, isolated in the front of it from the rest of the students. And they wanted to know what's going on. And so she just said to them very directly, this is a result of how you've been, how you've behaved, how you've gotten in the way of the learning, and so now you're in jail. That's the expression. She said, you're in jail, and you're parked here. I don't want to hear a thing. And she talked right in front of them. Right? So they're right underneath her like this, which is kind of intimidating. She's a fairly large woman, and you didn't want to, like, get cross-eyed with her. And so she used that, and it settled them down. They scrunched back. They might not have participated in class very much, but they didn't disrupt anymore. Mm-hmm. You know?
Did they eventually negotiate their way back?
One of them did. Yeah. One of them said, okay. Well, what happened was that it got back to his parents. But for parental question. And the parents said, And so it straightened him out. The other two, whatever. Yeah.
You mentioned this idea of the shining moment. Can you give us examples from your own practices?
Yes. I work with struggling fourth and fifth graders in reading and math, and we have a state test that the children must pass, and it's a pass-fail. You have to get 800, not 799. 799 is not good enough to pass. It has to be 800. And it doesn't matter if a child has gone from 620 to 799. They're still a failure. So the abhorrent thing. And at the end of the year, we have the test, and then we have 3 weeks before there is an opportunity for a retest. So I had a group of children who failed the test, didn't make the mark, and we gathered together and said, what are we going to do? We got this close, and we're not there. And part one of the Foxfire practices is teamwork and collaboration. So it's, let's look at what we've learned, where our problems were. We had all the data there, and I'm sharing it with them. I said, what we obviously don't know is measurement. This is the part where everybody's having trouble. So how can we do measurement? And we brainstormed some activities and whatever. And so we began to do the study. I said, but I'm going to explain what I understand about how you might do this example problem that will be on this very important test, but you may not get it from my explanation. I may say it, and that is not going to make any sense. You have to say that doesn't make sense, but you also have to say that does make sense, and maybe I can help another classmate understand it. And it became such a goal of that group for everyone to get over that darn point, the 800, that they were coming in at recess. They would come and sit with me at lunch. They on their own, and they passed. It was wonderful. It was just a shining moment. Mm-hmm. They're not always, but that one was.
The standardized testing aside, what role do students have in the Foxfire approach in the assessment of their work? Usually that's left to the teacher, but do you, in the Foxfire approach, do students become involved in the assessment of their own work and that of other students in the class?
One of the things that I've had some success with that I think is Foxfire-ish is taking our own writing or the stories that we're studying and becoming the test makers, not the test takers. And so the children look at models of what these standardized test questions look like and then use their materials to create questions for a real audience, other students. And that shifts the lens just enough that they then begin to think about what is it that makes the correct answer, what do the incorrect answers look like, and they just become more discriminating about the kinds of choices that they make. And I think that has really helped them become more skilled. Yeah, and they certainly are more engaged. They love doing it.
I can piggyback off of that. And one of the refinements we made in the Foxfire's core practices was in the assessment core practice, based on the need for more sophisticated assessments. And so we adjusted that core practice to reflect what the research was showing us and to encourage exactly that kind of cooperative activity in creating assessments. So one of the things we have folks do when they're going through the workshop is any rubric you use needs to show the students' fingerprints on it. They need to be able to see their words, their language in there, that they had an impact on what they're going to be trying to do. And then to revisit those, don't just stack them up and, okay, that's it. How did it work for the last time we did this? What kind of language do we need to shift and change to make this more sophisticated the next time? So it's scaffolding is not mentioned anywhere in the core practices, but scaffolding is very clearly all the way through Foxfire, is you never rest where you are. You're always pushing to the next level. I think probably Vygotsky has been a major influence in our thinking on that regard, is the zone of proximal development. Get the kids to this level, don't just rest there. Keep nudging them up, pushing them up so they develop more sophisticated skills, which again goes back to planning. You have to plan to enable that to happen and bring them with you. And you have to be attentive to the personalities and the dynamics of every single class because they're all unique.
And to go with what you're saying, the 10th core practice is assessment, rigorous ongoing assessment and evaluation. And I explicitly asked Hilton that when I participated in the workshop last summer, because my reality was at the end of a unit, they have to take a multiple choice post-test.
And get a grade.
It's what our grading requirement is. And at the end of the school year, they have to take a standardized test. In Georgia, it's called a CRCT, a competency reference
Criterion reference
competency test. Yeah. One for each subject area. Questions and questions, not unlike a SAT or a GRE or any standardized exam. And I said, Hilton, at the end, my students have to do this. So all of this Foxfire stuff about them showing me how they want to learn and all sounds wonderful. But when it comes time to do the actual assessment, how do we approach that? And I remember his response was, well, that's when you ask the students how they want to learn and keep on doing that, because if they're getting the information. Then when it comes test-taking time, you do need to practice a little bit with how do we actually use these standardized tests. What are they all about? Let's prepare, because now we have to show we know this information through this modality. Mm-hmm. And so now you're not losing their choice.
Right.
They still have ownership in how they're doing all of these things, but you're also preparing them for these givens, which obviously vary according to where you're at in your school.
Yeah. We had early in Foxfire's history of the teacher outreach program, we had a third grade teacher in Eastern Kentucky, one of three third grade teachers, and they had a standardized test that they had to pass. And her approach to this was to engage the students in all kinds of really interesting activities, and I could describe those at some length too, but she always connected them back to the curriculum. But she did absolutely no test prep. Her other two third grade colleagues were using some time every week for actual test prep kind of stuff. She refused to do that. 2 weeks out from the test date, she said to the class, we have this test coming up. Do you know anything about this test? Well, they'd heard some stuff. So they spent a day talking about what the test is and what the items are. And then they pretty much pushed aside all the rest of the sort of curriculum they were working on. And for 2 weeks, they essentially did nothing but test prep. Mm-hmm. They blew the test out of the water. They outscored the other two third graders by, I think, one standard deviation at least across the board. And this is in a really poor, difficult neighborhood area. So she showed them how you can really take care of the test situation in a very effective way.
I wanted to come back to the shining moments. We heard Sarah's. Maybe Hilton, you can give us an example.
One that it always comes back to me, it was the government class I had at Raven County High School. A very mixed kind of crew of kids. Some were academically pretty savvy, but a lot of them, high school was going to be a terminal career sort of thing for them. And at that time, the southeastern states who had developed this consortium for handling nuclear waste, and South Carolina had been the first state to ante up to take nuclear waste, but North Carolina was next in the rotation of states to do this. And several sites were identified in North Carolina as possible places to put this. And one site was identified as in the mountain area right north of where we are. Raven County is in the northeast corner of Georgia, and North Carolina is right there. And it is mountainous, and the roads are curvy, and there are major aquifers in the area. But that was an area that was identified as one possible site for nuclear waste storage. So our students, being somewhat environmentally sensitive, began to ask questions about this. And as it grew in the class, it became a consensus in the class that this was an issue that deserved some time. So one group of four boys, all boys, decided that that would be a sort of a project within the government class, because this obviously has to do with politics and government as well as other things and economics, because that's why they wanted that. People wanted this thing because it was an economic boon to any area to have this nuclear site. So they researched nuclear waste, the storage of it, and all that kind of stuff, and developed a protocol of questions. So when they started having hearings up in that area right north of us near Franklin, North Carolina, started having hearings about this nuclear waste site thing, they got permission to go and interview just the citizens in the area as well as members of the hearing group and the community politicians. But they were able to ask such informed questions that they couldn't be dusted off as just kids curious doing a journalism thing. And what happened is they began to plant the seeds of doubt in the area because they were able to ask these informed questions about it and then also to write this up. And their writings then became immediately available as they came back to the class and with classmates edited them, those into a neat journalistic pieces. And there was one of the reporters in the local newspaper in Franklin was observing this phenomena. She knew about Foxfire. And she said, they were supposed to have six hearings. They canceled that site after three. It was no longer in consideration. And the work of those Raven County High School students with their interviews and asking questions was a major factor, according to this a journalist in that area, in having them discontinue the hearings and to take that off as an option. That's, I get tingly when I think about that. Mm-hmm.
David?
Well, what comes to my mind is the sometimes part where a moment didn't shine.
Yeah, I can do those too.
Yeah,
me too.
Because you don't want to make it seem like every moment is shine, because it really is.
It is.
So with eighth graders, we were studying math, and eighth grade math is very intense, and I guess it will continue to become more intense as we have these higher standards and expectations. So they're doing, it's an algebra, it's solving two-step equations. So they're using variables, and they're using positive and negative integers, and they're using the distributive property of multiplication. And they're working on this. Well, this is kind of, and then I'm working with it, this is a class of just English language learners. So they don't quite understand the English, and then they have to do this math. Some of them got it, though. So finally, I said, look, some of you get it, some of you don't, and I don't know what else I can do. What do you guys want to do? And they came up with this idea to come up with different ways to teach each other. And one girl that had come from Italy, who spoke Italian, she loved singing and dancing, so she made up a song, this song that would kind of stick in your head with the steps. It was great. And these other little girls, they got together and they made this, they did a presentation on the board, but they found a way to record it without them being in it, because they didn't want to physically be seen, but you could see the writing, and then one of them narrated, first I do this, then I do that. So they had all the literacy components in. Well, I let this group of boys work together, and they wanted to make a soccer game. that involved solving equations to get from the next part. I said, it sounds great. I want to play that game when you're done, you know, because you have to do a math problem. And I would monitor them, and they'd always have a, oh, we're doing this and we're doing that. By the end, they made the hardest math problems for this game, and they spent so much time making this elaborate board and these really cute little players out of clay and artistically gorgeous that we covered. They covered basically no math.
Yeah.
And so I you know, always wanted to encourage them. That's great. You know, how are we gonna move into this math? But each time I would kind of go away and let them, you know, work on their own, they'd get back into, you know, the soccer field wasn't measured perfect. They were trying to get scale. You know, they were on the wrong details. And I realized that I needed to be a little more present with them collaborating. So that particular moment didn't shine.
Right.
And that's really the heart of the teacher's challenge with this way of teaching, is that you constantly have to be saying, how much, when is it time to step in?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's hard to know, because if you step in too soon, you thwart their ideas, mm-hmm. and you cut them off, and you limit them, and they shut down. Mm-hmm. But if you don't step in soon enough, then they may not have the maturity or whatever to get to the goal. So that's the constant challenge.
Yeah. Constant monitoring of, mm-hmm. of how things are going, yeah.
And when you have 7 classes and you have so many students, and in today's environment where people, the people who make the rules for teachers don't understand what a complex enterprise teaching and learning is, then sometimes you almost are frustrated that your hands are tied. But you take a deep breath and go back to the shining moments.
Yeah, one of the things that we've been emphasizing in recent years, is sort of looking at that phenomena, is how to build a sense of community with each class and being discreet. Mm. And this starts with such simple things like, do not put a bunch of stuff on your walls in your classroom, because that becomes eyewash, disappears. If those walls can be used for very purposeful things, that is, you can say that wall belongs to period 1, that wall belongs to period 2, and student work can be up there and can be transitory, and that begins to give it some meaning. Mm-hmm. And students will even start looking at the work of other periods. You're doing that way. So even little steps like that might help build a sense of community in there. And I remember there was a teacher who inherited a very dysfunctional class from another teacher. And I observed that class earlier, and it had sleepers in it. It had kids who were like working night jobs and would sleep, mm-hmm. kids that just sort of sulled and would not cross their arms and sort of wouldn't do. If they failed, that was fine. Didn't care about that. So she inherited this class, and she talked to them about building a community, like on their first day or so.
Continue.
Talked to them about building a community. And one day, she was doing one-on-one talks with the students' assignments. So they would do like 5 minutes, and then then 5-minute talks with all of them, how they were doing. That in itself was very important, 5 minutes with individuals. But one student sat down beside her, and she said, look, it's a community. Every other student was at work. The sleepers were working. The kids with the crossed arms were working. Every single student was engaged. And it's because she had brought them to that point of having a sense that they were doing this together. Yeah.
It occurs to me that the oral history part that we've been talking about with you this week has real potential,
yes.
for that, that building of community. I haven't done as much with the oral history in the way that you kind of laid it out in the notebook that I was reading last night. But I have sent home cameras, those disposable cameras, to my kids and said, okay, there are 12 of us, there are 36 pictures on this roll. Everyone go and take a picture of something that's important to you, that you want us to know about you. We can't all go to your houses, so take 3 pictures. And it's your responsibility to bring it back, because if you don't, you will lose the pictures of the people who have taken them before, and the people after, you won't have one. So So far, everyone's always brought back the cameras, and we develop the pictures, and then they choose from their three, and they write about not just what's in the picture, not just what you see, but what you don't see. And we put those up, and we learn so much about each other that way. And I do it, too. So those are our stories, and those stories are what help us understand one another. That, I think, is why we don't fight so much, or maybe have more compassion. Not always. Oh, it still happens. But it's certainly a step.
Mm-hmm. I mean, oral historians sort of look to Foxfire as sort of the beginning of using oral history in the classroom, and so they sort of approach it from a different side, right? Rather than oral history being a tool of Foxfire, it's this is how oral history can be used in the classroom. Do you have any other experiences with oral history that you can share with our listeners, readers?
Well, one thing I think is relevant to the question you just posed is that Foxfire was flying along, getting a national reputation, doing all these things, and in the mail one day we got this package from a guy who is a former teacher up in North Central Ohio, and he had done cultural journalism oral history projects back in 1938. Okay, and so what we discovered from him is that there was in fact a kind of tradition or a strand in American education of this kind of investigation of one's own culture and the areas around you. So we didn't know it, but we were tying into something that had been there before. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a chastening moment, but also it was kind of an affirming moment too. Mm-hmm. You got that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Many of the people who will be listening to this interview will be university educators. Does Firefox speak to the university environment?
Well, David can probably talk about this too, but in my own teaching, teaching graduate studies primarily, and I use the core practices. And if things are not functioning, not going the way I think they probably should be, inevitably, if I will go look at the core practices, I will notice I'm not attending to number 9, I'm not attending to number 2, I'm not thinking about number 4, whatever. And it gives me the basis for making some adjustments in what we're doing. So it is extremely relevant. And I think a lot of times at the university level, we acquire students who have become effective at dealing with, they become skilled students able to do the work and get good grades. And so they have the system down. And as a result, we miss many, many opportunities with them to elevate them to a much higher level of inquiry, which I think is so essential and missing. And so what Foxfire does is it promotes that kind of inquiry to take responsibility for not just learning stuff that's to be replicated or sent back. It's to create new knowledge. It can be added to, and you can do that starting. You can do that as a freshman, and in fact, you can do that as a high school student, as a middle grade student. You can add to our body of useful knowledge that we can acquire. So I think that at the university level, I think that definitely would be the point. And I'm beginning to see in some of my colleagues at Piedmont College some real interest in doing this, with particularly the undergraduate programs. I'm beginning to see, and we've got probably 6 to 8 now arts and science faculty members who are trained in the Foxfire approach. And you can really sense a difference in how they approach their subject matters and what happens as a result of that approach with their students.
And there may be a thirst for this kind of voice that is being ignored. Just yesterday, one of the participants in our institute, when we were leaving, said to me, "This is what I envisioned university work to be like, and it wasn't." And that was such an affirming thing, that this was what she wanted, that she was hoping, if I can just get to university, then I can participate too. I can be recognized as an equal voice. And yet for her, it had not happened in university. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a thirst for it that we're just not tapping into. Mm.
I think it's obvious it's a very big issue you're addressing, because there's, of course, the agendas of the university, the agendas of the faculty, the agendas of the students that are matriculating. and such, and that's obviously going to play a role in that. But as a student, I think the students can tell when there's the absence of their voice, you know, especially if you're considering faculty that are preparing students to become teachers. And then, you know, an example, almost cliche, would be, let me teach you about how you would use group work and how you would use flexible grouping and how you would, you know, incorporate student voice into the class. But the faculty, the university teacher delivers that via lecture.
Yeah, and we use the expression frequently, be the thing. Wherever we are, we have to model it, have to be the thing. Yeah.
And there's that overwhelming human nature resistance to change, to always do things the way that they have been done. It's scary to take a risk, to go out, to do things differently. Mm-hmm. So there's that part too.
Mm-hmm. Great. I think we're out of time. Again, Sarah, Hilton, and David, thank you very much for coming up to Winnipeg and telling us all about Foxfire, and I hope we can use this interview to spread the word.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
The opportunity.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's very good.